Okay, are we ready to jump in again?
You don't know how perfect timing that is, that's perfect timing.
Yes, and again, please tell me your name till I get to know, what?
Justine Barrera.
Okay.
Jules is good.
Back to the farming topic.
Yeah.
Would that also entail farming as far as like milk, production of milk and eggs and so on and so forth? Can I ask you, but I don't know, when I was growing up I remember that they were dumping milk. And I don't remember what the cause for that was, if it was because of the cause of the milk or... So my question is, does the government also have a hand in that? As much as they do with the farming and like the...
I know they do have a hand in milk and other dairy products. Just what would explain a particular act of dumping milk, I don't know. It could depend on the circumstances. But it's the kind of thing you would do in an effort to get the price higher by reducing the supply. So, anything else? I wanted to say a little bit more in connection with the subject of price control. I think the thought was expressed that either the government may control prices or private firms control prices, that this is something that private individuals can do no less than the government. I think in reality, private firms do not control prices. They set prices, but the mere setting of prices is not the same thing as controlling prices. A price control is a price imposed by the government against the will of the private parties. The prices are set voluntarily by the private parties. That should not be considered price control. The setting of prices is not the controlling of prices. Price control is the government forcibly imposing a price against the will of the private parties who are setting prices. So if I would like to open a restaurant and I'm setting a price of $35 for a steak, that's not controlling the price. There's price control if the government enters the picture and tells me, no, I can't charge more than $30. That's a price control. But my free choice to charge $35 or whatever, that's simply the setting of prices. It's not price control. Price control is the government compelling people to charge different prices than they voluntarily would have. Yes, and you are again, I'm sorry?
Sir, Dylan Wright.
Dylan Wright, yes.
So I guess the only question I would have is, what about in the cases where demand is inelastic? Would those be considered?
Even where demand is inelastic. Demand is inelastic. An inelastic demand means that the price will rise disproportionate to a fall in the supply. So if when the supply falls in half, the price more than doubles, that's an inelastic demand. Well, nothing is more common than inelastic demands. Just think of the demand for any kind of spare part. Think of all of the things without which something would not be functional. Like suppose you couldn't get spark plugs for your automobile. What happens to the usefulness of your whole car? Or you couldn't get a fan belt or whatever. So the whole car depends on the availability of this little item. Potentially, what would you be willing to pay to have this item? A huge price. So the demand is immensely inelastic. But so what? The sellers are not in a position to take advantage of that.
Well, again, if they did attempt to control prices, it would simply foment crime. I mean, people, if they need it, they're going to get it, type of thing. I mean, these necessities, the barest necessities.
Yeah. Well, the market, the way you prosper is by offering more things at lower prices. Not fewer things at higher prices. That's the way firms grow large. Now you see, typically people have the idea if you're a large, substantial seller, or you are the only seller of something, that goes along with charging stupendously high prices. Now, that's true if what makes you the only seller is some exclusive legal privilege. If the government says only you may supply this item and everyone else is prohibited from doing so, well, then you can take advantage of your position and charge a very, very high price. But suppose you have something that could be produced possibly by many people. And I think this is really typically the case. Certainly in the great majority of minerals and agricultural products, do we use all the land that is capable of growing crops to grow crops? There's an awful lot of land that could grow crops that lies idle. Do we exploit every mineral deposit that contains some given type of mineral? Are all of the veins of iron ore being exploited? Are all possible sources of petroleum being exploited? There are very, very few cases where that would be true. Well, what would you have to do if there are many, many people who potentially could produce something, but you want to be the producer? You want to keep them out of the market, but you can't resort to force, you can't prohibit them. What would you have to do so that you can be a major factor in the market and others will not be able to compete with you?
Be the most efficient,
charge prices that are too low for others who might do the job to find it profitable to do so. And that's really the typical relationship, I think. Yes, and again, please tell me.
Calvin Chung.
Yes.
When you say that the less efficient firm will still get a free ride with in the market if the supply falls short or something?
Yeah, if the supply falls short, if there's something that holds back a more efficient firm, then for a time, the less efficient firm can prosper. So that happens. If you have a situation where there's a major increase in the demand for something, in those circumstances, perhaps everybody in the industry makes a lot of money. But in normal circumstances, where the more efficient firms have idle capacity, are in a position to meet more customers, they will normally be charging prices that are too low for the less efficient firms to be very profitable.
Well, so say for instance in the oil industry, so if one company is less efficient and still gets the same, I would say, the revenue or still profit, you know, as the efficient firm is, not in terms of revenue, but in terms of profit margin, is there any reason for the less efficient firm to improve their productivity and invest into, you know, increasing the more efficient?
I think what I heard you say is the less efficient firm will have the same profit margin as the more efficient firm?
No, not necessarily, but same proportion of the efficient firm. And so if that's the case, then...
It wouldn't have the same proportion. It would have the same selling price. Now, a good illustration, there was an article, I think, in today's New York Times about extracting oil from tar sands in Canadian Alberta. And they make the point that it only pays to do this so long as oil is above $30 a barrel. Now, because they have very, very high costs, they get, I think, one barrel of oil from 2 tons of tar sands. And they have to engage in a lot of processing. At the same time, light sweet crude oil in Saudi Arabia may be extracted at $2 a barrel. But in Alberta, the cost may be on the order of $30 a barrel. Now, if the price of oil gets up to $40, then in Alberta, they make $10 profit per barrel. And in Saudi Arabia, they're making $38 profit. Now, would the Canadian producers have an incentive to be more efficient, to get the cost of extracting oil from tar sands down if they could? Well, certainly they do. If they could get it down to $20, that would be a huge improvement for them. So they do have that incentive. Yes?
I had a question going back to the farming industry, do you know where a good resource is that to find out how to be on the benefiting side of it if you wanted to go into farming maybe one day? How do I find out all the details?
How do you get the subsidies? I'm sure the Department of Agriculture has some literature. And then there's some character who every so often shows up doing television commercials dressed very flamboyantly and screaming. I was telling you how to get rich from the government. I don't know if he has anything to say or not.
All right.
Yes.
I understand that there's a lot of subsidies given by the government to the private farmers.
Yeah.
But already we're producing an excessive amount of farming products.
Yeah.
Why are they still giving breaks to?
Why does the government? Why does the government subsidize farmers when we have a surplus?
Right.
I mean, well, the subsidies are causing the surplus, but the reason they give the subsidies is that in many states, the farmers decide the outcome of senatorial elections. And so they have tremendous political influence. They're a political bloc. I don't know just how many senators may depend on them, but it's enough. So they engage in trading votes back and forth. So if you want a tariff and you promise to support the farmers, the farm senators will vote for your tariff and so on. Yes, and Larry Barton.
The question I have is it also possible that they subsidize the farmers to keep them in the farming business because perhaps in the future there could be a shortage and therefore they don't lose the land, they don't lose the farm product, and also the fact that their land is available for use if it's needed. So, and to keep them to where they won't now become unemployed and go out and seek another form of employment.
All right. Do we have farm subsidies in part to assure the food supply?
Yes.
In effect, is what you're asking. I'm sure many people who support subsidies advance that argument. Mm-hmm. Maybe they believe it. But I don't think that's really necessary. We don't need a continual production of farm surpluses to assure the food supply. The commodity speculators regularly do that. So you just think it's the profession of people to follow the supply of food and the demand for food extending out to the next 2-3 years. We have futures markets. You have a market, a price today, for December 2005 wheat, or a month give or take, and even further out than that, and anything that may threaten the supply shows up immediately in higher futures prices, which immediately start restricting the rate of consumption. Anything that entails a bigger supply brings the price down. So the market is adjusting present and future. And there are people, the outlook for agriculture is factored into the price of agricultural land. If it's the case that there's land presently lying idle, but which might be needed to produce more food, well, that has an influence in raising the price of that land. So it's there. Yes, the gentleman back here.
My name's Ben.
Ben what?
Ben what? Cutshaw?
Okay. Yeah.
My question, you gave me the example earlier about in that same scenario, Japan, you know, making the reason for the rice, present rice, for, you know, production of their own food to be self-sufficient.
Yeah.
My question then is, does it kind of depend, or is there a relationship then between a completely free market in the country and a strong military? What effect does that have? Do they have on each other?
What is the relationship between a free economy and a strong military?
You made the example that, yeah, you know, United States Navy could ensure supply lines to Japan,
yeah,
if there was some threat to their food supply coming,
yeah,
in.
Yeah.
In a completely free society where markets are completely free, wouldn't that be dependent on a strong military where those supply lines could in fact be enforced?
Well, you do need a certain level of military, of defense to keep supply lines open, yeah. And so if your question is, does a free economy depend on a government and an armed force, Yeah, a free economy depends on a military and also on such things as a police force and a system of courts and laws. People have to be secure from other people's use of force. Yeah. Suppose robbers could just walk willy-nilly into stores. If there was no resistance, that sort of thing could paralyze the economy. So you have to protect private property and people's persons against aggression in order to have economic activity. Yeah. Yes, and you are Chris?
Chris Corman.
Corman, yeah.
To Ben's point again, the need for police or military is necessary only if there's a threat. There's no intrinsic need for military force to aid economic growth.
No, it doesn't aid economic growth, but it defends it against possible threats.
Only if there's a threat.
Yeah, if there's a threat.
Ben's question was, what's the relationship? I think the only relationship is if there's a threat. If there's no threat, there is no relationship.
You say there's no threat, then there's always a threat.
Yeah, but if there weren't, then there's no relationship.
It's not a positive. It's something that protects you from destruction. It's the negation of a negative. That what an army does is negate a negative. If it's functioning properly. Okay. Just perhaps one last observation in connection with the issue of private price control. This is really a wider subject. It's very, very common for people to make no distinction between private action and government action. And so just as they talk of private price control alongside of government price control, it's also very common for people to talk of private censorship alongside government censorship, and to say such things as if a newspaper refuses to run a column, that's censorship. Suppose I write an article and the newspaper doesn't like it. Or suppose someone writes a play that's very offensive to the sponsor of the program and he refuses to advertise it, and so the station pulls the play. Now, there are a lot of people who would say, well, that's censorship. But I would say that is not censorship. The fact that you can't find someone to promote your views if they don't endorse your views, it's not censorship. Where censorship would exist is when private individuals are prepared to support your views, and then they're stopped by the government. So if I want to give you a lecture at 2 a.m. in your bedroom, and you throw me out, you're not violating my freedom of speech. That's not a violation of my freedom of speech, the fact that there's something I can't say in certain circumstances. But suppose you were willing to invite someone into your home to give a lecture, and people were willing to attend, and so there's the voluntary cooperation of all the private parties, and then the police show up to prohibit it. That would be censorship. That would be a violation of freedom of speech. Freedom is violated by the government, not by private individuals going about their peaceable business, even though it may mean that there are certain things others can't do. There are all kinds of things we can't do, but that doesn't mean that our freedom is violated. I can't walk out of this room right now and fly off to Hawaii and keep my job. That's something I can't do.
I'm okay with it.
Okay, you're okay with it. Okay, but if I want to keep my job, there are certain things I can't do. I may want to marry someone, and she doesn't want to marry me. Then I can't marry her. That's not a violation of my freedom. My freedom would be violated if she consents to marry me, and then the government says no. That would be a violation of freedom of marriage. If I want to leave a given job and take another, and I'm prepared to accept the consequences, and the government says no, that's a violation of my freedom of employment. Freedom is essentially violated only by the government.
So would that be, Pamela, the same for gay marriages then? Yeah. The government says,
but if you want to marry a man?
When they both are consensual? Is that the same?
If the government says that two people cannot have a relationship, that would certainly be a violation of their freedom. I'm not so sure about the government saying you cannot have a marriage, because this would get into an issue of what is the nature of marriage. See, it's something I really prefer not to get involved in. We have enough controversy in economics. So let me beg off that one, okay? I'm sorry, you had a question?
I was just going to say that applies also to women that breastfeed in public. You know,
okay, you mean something that could be construed as indecency or something?
Right now,
consistent recognition for private property rights, and we recognize that you have a private property right not just to your own home but to your business. If we regarded business as private and the owners as having the right to determine what goes on in a business, well, then you might have, let's say, some restaurants. There could be some restaurant owners who would say, fine with me if women are breastfeeding in my restaurant, and then there would be others who'd say, no, I don't go for that. And they would decide as they deemed fit. And then, to the extent it made a difference to business, if there were hordes of breastfeeding mothers who would be a major market, you might have some restaurant owners who personally were offended by it who would say, okay, I'm willing to allow it because I want the business. The same solution could be applied to smoking in restaurants. This doesn't have to be a matter of law. If it were left up to the private property rights of the owner, then the owner would be interested in doing, we'd have some restaurants that are non-smoking, others that were only for smokers, and others that would be mixed, and people would decide where they wanted to go. We don't have to have an all or nothing decision for everybody. And that's one of the beauties of the market. You know, we don't have a one uniform automobile. We have all kinds of different models catering to different tastes and preferences, and so you can have the same thing with various social preferences too if you leave it up to the private owners. Yes?
Thank you, Richard. But if I am the owner of the bar and I want to let people smoke in there, yeah, the government's telling me I can't do that now.
Right.
I'm being censored.
Yes, I would say that the government is not respecting your property rights by prohibiting smoking in restaurants.
Pardon me? The law is doing it, or the government is doing it, protecting the people.
Yes, it says it's protecting the people, but if the restaurant owners can't yank non-smokers in and force them to be exposed to the smoke, if you know, here's a smoking place, I don't like smoke, I'm not going in, well, then you don't go in. If you do like to smoke, go in. So you could have different establishments catering to different preferences. That's, I think, one of the beauties of the free market. We don't have an up and down vote. The majority decides what everybody must do. We have freedom of choice. Okay, well, let us turn to further matters. We've just gotten to the broken window. Someone pointed out that the exact same ideas are present in the wider fallacy, the blessings of destruction. There are people who think that there's nothing better for prosperity than a good war. And they imagine all of the houses that have been destroyed that will need rebuilding, all of the appliances that haven't been produced in the duration of the war that now need to be produced. And they think on this basis that a war with its massive destruction is nevertheless a source of prosperity. Well, as Hazlitt points out, that's simply not true. We don't need a war to give people jobs. They can have jobs instead of rebuilding things. producing new and additional things alongside the things that have not been destroyed. A war represents not new and additional employment and prosperity. It represents a massive diversion from the production of civilian goods to the production of military goods, from the production of new and additional goods to the replacement of destroyed goods. So it is really an economic loss, not a gain. Yes?
Could it be, stimulate the economy by, the war itself could stimulate the economy in a way that, while that you have other products that already reached their, maximum capacity of production, so, you can't produce anymore, while the economy is stagnant, and then so by stimulating it, it's by spending money.
Okay, tell me again your name.
Calvin Chung.
Mr. Chung. One of these days I'll get everybody's name. Mr. Chung asks if a war might not stimulate the economy because essentially people are sated with everything else. They have all of the other goods that they want, and they're at a loss for what to produce, and you need a war to put them to work. Well, do you know anyone who's sated? Do you think even Bill Gates is sated? I think he had, at last count, $40 billion or something. Is he interested in acquiring still more wealth?
Oh, yeah.
Does he have any useful purpose for it? Well, it might be curing world hunger. Who knows? Just think, what are the kinds of things, the kinds of purposes for which more wealth is desired? So long as you have any objective that requires the application of material means and human labor, wealth is the means of achieving that objective. So are there people who have a curiosity to know what's on Mars? There's a Mars Society, right? Now, if we were going to be serious about exploring Mars and the rest of the solar system, how much wealth would you need? Can Gates afford that?
Yeah.
He might make a contribution, but it's not big enough. It would exhaust the wealth of the United States and the whole world at present. So there really is no limit. And think about it further. I don't know how much each of you makes, but whatever it is, do you think you'd have any great problems in adjusting to a standard of living twice as high?
No.
Real earnings twice as high? No. Now, just think for a moment. Let's imagine that you're presently earning $100,000 a year. But you could easily figure out ways of living up to $200,000 a year. It's not all that difficult, certainly today. How much labor would have to be employed to produce twice the goods and services for the average person?
For that person?
For that person, yeah.
Perhaps not more. It depends upon the value that that person brings to the marketplace.
Yeah, but how much labor, I'm talking about how much labor would have to be expended by other people to produce twice the value of goods and services.
Twice as much.
I would say on the order of twice as much.
Twice as much labor.
Twice as much as is presently satisfying him. Suppose, for example, you'd like twice as large a house. Shouldn't we expect that would take roughly twice the labor to produce?
There's some marginal gains.
Well, you need twice the materials, twice the time of installing everything. I would say it ought to be on the order of twice the labor. Pardon me?
Close.
Okay, reasonably close. So there's a lot more. How many of you jump out of bed every morning eager to make your own breakfast, make your bed, drive off to work? Wouldn't it be nice if someone were doing all that for you? Okay, how many people would we potentially want to employ just as servants? I would say maybe five per person. It's not that difficult. It's not that difficult. And the people providing the products you buy, the services you buy in the market, I would think without great difficulty at all, each of us could find ready employment for the labor of 10. And another way of looking at the same problem is, if you think of how much income you would be able to spend if only you could earn it, how many hours a week would you have to work to earn, at your present rate of pay, to earn the amount of income you'd like to spend?
Not enough hours in the day.
There are not enough hours. If you're presently working on the order of 40 hours a week, and you could think of ways that you could spend five times your present income, well, at your present rate of pay, you'd have to work 200 hours a week. There's only 168 in the week. You'd be hospitalized from exhaustion by the time you were working 80 or 85 hours. So what this implies is there is a tremendous, profound scarcity of human labor. The fundamental thing that is scarce in the world is our ability to produce. That's what's scarce. And we don't need to manufacture ways of employing labor. What we need to be concerned with is how to make labor more productive. Because how can we possibly achieve any part of what we'd like to achieve if we would really all like to have five times the standard of living we now have? Well, how much labor is available to achieve that? Just think, each of us in this class, I would think, could find ready employment for the labor of 10. We'd like to benefit, each of us, from the labor of 10 in producing the products and services we buy and in being our servants. But here we are, there's roughly 30 of us in this room. Collectively, we would like the labor of 300. But if this were a self-contained economic system, how much labor is available to satisfy our needs? Only the labor of 30. We'd like the labor of 300, but we have only the labor of 30. Well, that's an indication of the scarcity of labor. You would like five times your present income, but you cannot possibly perform the amount of work required to earn that income at your present rate of pay. So what is our actual economic problem? We need to become more productive. We need to get greater and greater results per unit of labor. We have to be more efficient. That's the real problem, not to invent work to be done, but to devise more efficient methods of working. That's the actual problem. And this relates to another major subject that Hazlitt discusses, the effects of machinery. Now, there are many, many people who believe that machinery causes unemployment. And there can be a certain very limited element of truth in that if you focus very, very narrowly on isolated occupations. There are cases where the demand for a product is inelastic. Wherever you have an inelastic demand, it's almost inevitable that if labor becomes more productive in that line, fewer people will be needed. Imagine product that probably has the most extremely inelastic demand of any is table salt. No one is waiting to salt his steak more heavily for the price of table salt to drop. What would happen if, through some series of inventions, we could produce the same quantity of table salt we now produce, but with half the total labor? What would happen to employment in the production of table salt? I think we'd end up with half the number of workers producing the same quantity of table salt that we now have. There'd certainly be much less employment in the production of table salt. But would this mean there'd be less employment overall? No. And one way to see that there wouldn't be is to recognize that what would be the effect, at least in the long run, of being able to produce table salt with half the total labor. What do you think would be the effect on the cost and price of table salt? I think that would go down on the order of half. Mm-hmm. All right, now, if that's the case, what would people be doing with the half of the funds they used to spend in buying table salt, but now no longer need to because its price has halved? They'd be buying various other things. And to produce the additional quantity of those various other things, you would need the labor or the equivalent of the labor released from the production of table salt. So there'd be less employment in table salt, but more employment in the production of other things that people previously couldn't afford. Now, this, in fact, is the way machinery works. And if you want a major historical illustration, just think what has been the effect of machinery overall on the output per unit of labor, say, since 1800. If you had to attach a number to it, how much more would you say is produced per hour of labor today than in 1800 in the United States? Maybe 1,000 times, some huge multiple. Okay, now, if it were the case that machinery caused unemployment and we had close to full employment in 1800, what should be the unemployment rate today?
100%.
Maybe we should have 1/1,000th of the population working and the other 999/1,000th unemployed if the machines are doing the equivalent of what 999 workers did. There should only be one worker working because the machines have taken away the jobs of 999. But now, do you think the unemployment rate is significantly different today than in 1800?
No,
no, it isn't. It may even be somewhat less. Well, how do you explain the fact that we have this thousandfold rise in output per unit of labor and no significant effect on unemployment? Well, what do you think has happened to the total output? The output per capita has increased on the order of 1,000. We have pretty much the same proportion of the population working, but producing radically more. There's no unemployment. The pattern of employment is different. A much smaller percentage produces farm products. Nobody is producing, or hardly anybody is producing horseshoes, but there are huge numbers of people working in the production of things that didn't even exist earlier. Yes, I'm sorry to have kept you
okay.
off.
Just a comment. Back in the 1800s, start of the Industrial Revolution, I know in England there was a big problem with people that were in service, working as servants.
Yeah.
They all left service to go and work in the factories.
Yeah.
So there was actually a problem of there wasn't enough. I guess it's exactly the opposite, less than unemployment, because the people that wanted servants couldn't get them because all those people could make more money working in the new factories.
Right.
So that almost turns into a different situation where it was work for everybody.
Well, what you're describing is absolutely true. The cost of servants tremendously increased. People were better off in the factories.
So
fewer people could afford servants.
So that's why we don't have servants today, I guess, right?
We have far fewer servants, and also at the same time, many innovations have made it possible for people to do for themselves what they previously needed servants for. So it's one thing to dump a load of clothes in a washing machine, and then a half an hour later you put them in a dryer. That beats the hell out of having to scrub each item in a bucket. So it's much less painful not to have the servants. Now, we probably would have more people having servants if we had freer immigration. A ready outlet, in the United States, the middle class does not employ many servants. Maybe they have a maid once a week or something. But many people in the middle class could afford full-time servants if their wage rates were much lower, as they would be if we had large-scale immigration from poorer countries. Yes.
Well, I agree with you 100%. I lived in South America for a few years, and yeah. It's like I had a full-time maid, and you know, I was a volunteer. I didn't even have a full-time job. But like everybody has a maid, you know, and I didn't have to make my bed, wash the dishes, or even cook. And you know, she just did everything, and it's just because she was willing to work for like a dollar a day or something.
Yeah. Yeah, but where would these people live that came out and took that lower wage? There's no real estate available.
Live in your house would be.
There would be many live-in servants, probably. There'd be many live-in servants.
Yes. We think covered in the stairs.
Slow process where everybody has to transition to acquire new skills and training. For example, the outsourcing was popular right now.
Yeah.
Most people are laid off, but they have to acquire coming back to school to acquire new skills.
Yeah.
Well, that in the short run affects the economy.
Yeah.
You know, then to prosper in the long run.
Yeah, people, there are always changes going on, and people have to learn new skills. You can't expect to do the same job from late adolescence to old age, because there's innovation, and at one or more times in life, the innovation may cost you your existing job. So you need to learn fresh things. Now, many people don't, or most people, in fact, shouldn't be in the position of having to learn new skills after they've lost their job. I would say normally you can see the loss coming and make preparation while you still have your job, and hopefully that's the situation of many of you. You're here getting a business degree in the expectation that if you do lose your job, it'll be much easier to find an alternative. Yes?
Didn't we see a large example of this just recently with the reduction in the defense industry? We have this gigantic pool of people with degrees and advanced degrees who no longer had a particular way to put their services to use for pay.
Right.
Then had to learn additional skills to go to the marketplace to kind of reach to a new employment.
Yeah, exactly. Now that you're referring to the 90s and the end of the Cold War. Yeah, that was a large-scale conversion. And people did have to learn new skills for that. And your name, sir?
James Davis.
James Davis. Right. Okay. Yes?
Keith Wilson. Can we jump back to the destruction, arguing the destruction of property? He had a section in there about reincorporating the troops back into society. And to
oh, yeah, and has the disbanding troops and bureaucrats? Yeah.
Right. I'm just trying to put in kind of today's perspective where we try to keep an armed forces employed. I mean, the way you wrote it was, you know, bring up the troops when they're needed and then kind of bring them back in and disband it when, you know, when the war is over. But, you know, how does that kind of really apply when we're still, you know, maintaining the troops and keeping them?
Well, Hazlitt was writing in the context of the post-World War II years. And in World War II, we had an army, a whole defense establishment, on the order of maybe 15 million people.
Whoa. What's it right now?
Now, what is it, maybe 2 million or so? Maybe somewhat more?
I think 1.5.
1.5? Okay. Well, and at that time, when we had 15 million people, the population of the whole country was only about 130 million. Now it's close to 290 million. So this was a massive defense establishment, which we had in order to win World War II. And when the war ended, there was absolutely no rational basis for maintaining such an immense defense establishment. And many, many people were afraid that if we disband the army, there'll be a sudden massive unemployment in the civilian sector. What will the soldiers do? Well, all you have to do is realize that if we no longer need to maintain a massive defense establishment, then government spending is in a position to drop dramatically. And it did fall dramatically between 1945 and 1946. In 1945, it was something on the order of $100 billion, which was huge for that time. And in 1946, it was cut more than in half, down to about $45 billion. Now, this meant that the government is spending $55 billion less. There's $55 billion more remaining in the hands of the citizens. And so now they decide to spend it as they wish, instead of the government buying huge quantities of tanks, planes, artillery shells, and whatever. The individual citizens are out there buying automobiles, houses, washing machines, etc. And the workers who had been producing for the war effort, and including the soldiers and sailors, they now shift into producing for peacetime use. So instead of having Detroit, whoever is working in Detroit, producing jeeps and tanks, we now have the people in Detroit producing automobiles and trucks, and joined by returning soldiers. And so we had a massive increase in civilian production, and that's when prosperity really returned to the United States. Not in World War II, but with the end of World War II. Yes?
Did tie. So that money was returned in theory, or the government cut spending in half. Is that money really returned to the citizens?
Yeah.
Did they cut taxes? Or
they cut taxes, and they reduced government borrowing. So instead of the government raising certain sums of money through borrowing, it borrows less. There's more money available for civilian purposes. Yes?
So my question is, it seems that each one of these principles that are argued by the author really speak to free market. Everything you've gone through so far, other parts of the book where it talks about, you know, let's not give this farmer a low interest loan. We should allow the farmer who is most efficient to be the person who obtains the loan. It seems that the argument on the other side is that if we don't do this, then certain people would have the opportunity, you know, to economically thrive. With all that being said, my question is, that argument is free market. What would the market, give us a picture of what the market would look like, what would our country look like if it were completely free market?
I would say it would be much more prosperous. People would be more contented. We'd have much better medical care. We'd have a much better school system. We'd have a much better highway system. In the same way that we replace the horse and buggy with the automobile, we have tremendous progress wherever there is any significant element of economic freedom. We'd have that much more consistently.
Let me add a component to my question.
Yeah.
Because I tend to agree with that.
Pardon me?
I tend to agree with that.
Yeah.
However, how do you explain, how do you rebut the argument that is made often? The reason why we need to have these controls, i.e. the farming example, is that if you don't, mass poverty will occur, or certain individuals would not be able to survive. But with your description you just made,
yeah,
it's all rosy. Everything's phenomenal, everything's great. So how would you rebut the argument that is often made as to why that bridge is built, even though there's not a need for a bridge, but we create jobs? You know, that's a consistent argument. How do you address that?
I think the major question you're asking pertains to poverty. It's certainly true that developments can occur that will make certain groups of people poorer than they were before, at least temporarily. Like if the demand for their services drops, or there's some competition that makes what they're doing obsolete. And so they can have a short-run decline in their standard of living. But always what's displacing them is a more efficient method of production, and people are not frozen rigidly into what they have been doing. They're almost always able to make some adjustment. And the result is that we have continuing progress raising the general standard of living. Now, as for poverty, I would say there's an awful lot that the government does that is making people unnecessarily poor. Let's start, take something, first of all, like the minimum wage. Now, if you recognize the principle that the higher the price of anything is, the smaller the quantity demanded, if we make wage rates artificially high, that means the quantity of labor demanded will be lower, and it will be less than the number seeking employment. The effect of the minimum wage law is to compel some people who might have been employed to be unemployed. That's not improving them. If they could have been employed making something, and had they been employed, they would have probably acquired some skills, some better work habits. They would then have had the basis for earning some more money later on. They'd have been better qualified by virtue of the work they had done. Now, that's one instance. But then there are more. The government does not simply have a minimum wage for low-skilled, unskilled workers. The minimum wage law applies to them. But there are other things the government does that are very similar for higher-skilled workers. What would be examples of the government in one form or another imposing minimum wages higher up the economic ladder? Well, what do labor unions attempt to do?
Sure.
Okay, labor unions are attempting to impose higher, artificially higher wage rates, in effect, a minimum wage for skilled workers or semi-skilled workers. Now, when they do that, what happens to the quantity of skilled and semi-skilled labor that's demanded at the higher wage rates? That's reduced, right? Now, that means there are fewer people employed as carpenters, plumbers, electricians, etc., than who might have been. And where do they go? Where do they go? They'll look for other jobs, lesser jobs, right? So they enlarge the supply of labor in lesser skilled areas. Now, in order to be absorbed in these lower skilled areas, what would have to happen to wage rates? They'd have to be lower. See, labor unions and other devices that artificially raise wage rates in some areas have the offsetting effect of reducing them in other areas, because they reduce the number of people who can be employed at the artificially high wages. They cause a spillover of labor. They enlarge the supply elsewhere, and it'll depress wage rates lower down. Now, suppose we have this kind of arrangement prevailing throughout the economic system. People are being displaced from certain areas because of the elevation of wage rates. They fan out into other lesser areas. And in these other lesser areas, suppose for whatever reason, either unions or habit and custom, the wage rates do not fall to absorb them. But if they're more skilled, more qualified, they're likely to become employed, and who will then lose their jobs? Lesser skilled people. And they'll crowd down. If they're more intelligent and ambitious than the people there, they can get employed. Where does the process stop? Who ends up bearing the burden of the unemployment? The least skilled, there's a concentration at the bottom. The government is powerfully depressing the wage rates of poorer people, not just by denying them employment altogether through a minimum wage, but in depressing the wages that would be sufficient to employ them. Now, suppose we abolish the minimum wage law. People at the bottom could get employed, but the wage rates might be horrendously low. What could we do to make it possible to employ more people at the bottom on better terms, to alleviate the pressure, so that as we were increasing the number of people working at the lowest jobs, people presently working in such jobs could move up to higher jobs? What would we need to do to make that possible? Well, how about totally free up the labor market? Abolish all artificial wage restrictions so that people who had the skills and abilities could find employment by successfully competing higher up the ladder. Then we'd alleviate pressure at the bottom. And what would be the effect of more people working at a higher level of skill and efficiency? What would be the effect of this on the supply of goods and on the prices of goods? They'd be less. So what would be the effect on the standard of living of poorer people?
Increase.
It would be increased. Now, what if also we didn't compel miserably poor people directly or indirectly to pay 15% of their earnings to Social Security? See, they're paying 7.5% directly out of their own wages, but what the employers are paying on their account, from the employer's point of view, that's part of their wages. Well, suppose the workers could get that. That would be a significant improvement. And similarly with all other fringe benefits. Then also, if we wanted to make the cost of living less, suppose we have free trade, make everything as inexpensive as possible. So more people would be employed, they'd be employed on better terms than are otherwise possible, and they'd be getting goods cheaper. That would be a genuine anti-poverty program. Those would be the lines. Yes, and
Dave,
tell me again your name.
Dave Rosendahl.
Right.
So So supposing these theories are true,
yeah.
then can you pinpoint a reason or a set of reasons why we're not using them, why they're not employed by our government or the country?
Well, I would say very few people are aware of the truth of these theories, and they have mutually exclusive ideas. They believe, you can think of it this way. There are two fundamentally, radically opposed methods of pursuing material self-interest. One method is that of the free market. In the free market, you're not allowed to resort to force or fraud. You can't point a gun at anyone. You can't steal from him. You can't commit fraud. Okay, now, what if the use of force is effectively taken off the table? And here you are. You want to serve your material self-interest. You want to be rich. What do you have to do if you cannot commit robbery, fraud, or anything of that kind? You have to deal with people honestly. They will only deal with you voluntarily. What do you have to do to get people to deal with you voluntarily? You have to make it worth their while. You have to satisfy their self-interest. Well, this is self-interest in a very positive, productive way. This is what generates all of our progress and prosperity. You want to make a fortune, invent some new or better product or a more efficient method of producing an existing one. If you do that, you're not only making your fortune, you're meeting the needs of the buyers. And everyone who deals with you does so to his advantage. That's the method of the free market. Relatively few people are aware of this or not aware of it very consistently. There is they're more familiar with a different approach to self-interest, which you can think of in terms of the mafioso. The mafia, its members presumably want to have a higher standard of living too. But how do they go about getting it?
Extortion.
They'll break your legs if you don't pay them off. They'll stage stick-ups, robberies, whatever. And I think that many, many people think when you talk of self-interest and the profit motive, that's how they understand it. They think it means that people will be looting and plundering one another. That it'll be a mad, insane race. Yes?
So you contend that it's ignorance?
It's essentially ignorance, yeah. It's essentially ignorance. Yes?
How does this... John Castillo, by the way.
John what?
John
Castillo. Castillo, yeah.
How does the role of the United States and kind of how we fit internationally in some of our foreign policy dictate a lot of what you're saying? You painted a pretty good picture here domestically, but I would assume that obviously we do a lot of things where the government spends a lot of dollars or back to the discretionary spending of the government. I would assume that a large portion of that's done internationally, which, oh, by the way, has probably caused us to be the type of nation that we are today. Again, you talk domestically. How does internationally play a role into why the government isn't like the way you envision it?
Well, I don't see the separation between international and domestic. The government does an awful lot of damage domestically as well as internationally.
Well, foreign policy is the way a lot of our government spends a lot of money.
I don't think the government is getting money from our international, from our foreign policy. But they're certainly spending it. And tell me again.
Bob
Weatherford.
The concept, applying to what John's saying, and frankly, right into minimum wages, you can turn around and say, take the biblical thing. Give a person a fish, feed him for a day, teach him how to fish, he can feed himself for a lifetime.
Yeah.
That instead of giving aid, give them the means. And by free trade, we're giving other countries the means to support themselves. They can create goods that they can sell. They don't need us to give, or any other country, to give foreign aid to them.
Right.
In the sense that we give. So just like it is contended that we cripple people with welfare.
Yeah.
We're crippling other countries with foreign aid. That if we had a true free market society, many of these problems would not, or a free market world,
Yeah, I didn't know that you had in mind foreign aid, but these are valid observations that Mr. Weatherford is making.
The unnecessary discretionary spending that was in the book.
What do you mean discretionary spending?
Well, I think that you pointed out, or I believe it was pointed out in this book, that,
yeah,
that obviously anything more that the government spends, other than really necessities, roads, bridges, police,
yeah,
military to defend the country, other than that, it's really kind of unwanted spending.
Well, I think the distinction you're referring to that Hazlitt is making, when he has the discussion, I think, of a bridge in connection with public works projects. And he says it's one thing if a bridge is needed to facilitate the flow of traffic. We have bottlenecks, and so a bridge is really needed. And he thinks that sort of government expenditure is legitimate, but if the government is spending to build a bridge, then you'd have to ask, other things equal, would they rather pay less or more? They'd rather pay less. Now, if their motive is not to have a bridge to solve some traffic problem, but their motive is to stimulate employment, if that's the idea, then do they want a more expensive or a less expensive bridge? Then they'd actually want a more expensive bridge because their objective is not really the bridge, it's giving people the work to do to produce the bridge. And he's totally opposed to that type of spending. He's saying government spending for public works for the purpose of making employment, that's totally destructive. Yes.
Well, for the purposes of public works projects, even if they want to spend less, because of political pressures, they may spend more anyway because of prevailing wage. Because, for example, I know the federal government, Orange County is a great example. All public works projects must be prevailing wage because there's a stabilization agreement with the union. So they're paying at least twice as much as they should be in labor just because of this agreement.
Yeah, there are laws, I believe, that require that government projects be carried out at union scales. And now, why do you think there are such laws?
The unions
have a lot of money to contribute to political campaigns. They influence a large proportion of their membership. So if you're a politician and you're pursuing your political self-interest just to get reelected, then you're going to be willing to enter into such deals. Now, you're not getting the money in your bank account. Probably not, but sometimes that happens too. But even if you don't get a penny in your bank account, you're getting a payoff through getting reelected. And their government projects are undertaken on this basis, what's going to bring in the most campaign contributions. You see, it's not something, what's the most economically profitable. If a business is engaged in something, it wants to do something profitable, but when it's doing something profitable, it's dealing with customers who don't have to deal with it. It has to satisfy the wants of the customers. It has to serve the self-interest of everyone it's dealing with. When the politicians are doing something to their material self-interest, well, what underlies their ability to serve their self-interest? What is it that leads us to have to pay twice the cost of projects because they've decided to have this clause of paying union wages? Who foots the bill and on what basis? We do, and what makes us pay twice as much? What happens if you say, well, I know the story of this, it's a racket, and I'm deducting that sum from my quarterly tax payment? What will happen to you? At some point, maybe after a succession of progressively nastier letters, you'll end up, there'll be some armed officer at your door, and you'll be physically carted off.
Isn't that a form of governmental extortion in itself?
Yeah. You'd have to say that. Yes.
What you could also do is, just like Arnold did, you could run for a political position and say, you know what, I'm not going to take any notice of those special interest people, I'm just going to go with what the people wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how you'd break something like that. So as a person, as an American, you have the right, you can run for political office and do that if you have the money to do it.
But yep. it didn't work because we gave so much away on that budget that continues the social welfare program of the legislature that, fine, he didn't take any special interest money. Mm-hmm. Congratulations. The budget that he compromised that he had to come through with still...
But it's still better than it was before.
That's a matter of...
It's certainly not a dramatic improvement.
Yeah, yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Yes, Mr. Boisio.
Yeah. Is there a society or country that is truly free market or has been that is utilizing the policies that we're talking about now? And if so, was it or is it successful?
Well, I would say historically the United States came closest, and compared to most of the rest of the world, is still relatively free. And the extent to which we have prosperity, I would say, depends on the free elements. I mean, it still is possible for people to start new businesses, to introduce brand new products, new methods of production, and they do it on their own initiative, for their own profit. And so the economy is still powered by that, but there are more and more obstacles and barriers in the way. And I would say, if you look around at the world, I think there's a pretty close correlation between the freer the country, the more prosperous. Yes.
But is there in history an example of, I think that's where you're going, right? Is there a specific example?
I kind of answered it, you know, the United States is the closest to that. But
that's it.
You know, we talk about the artificially inflated wages. I mean, is there any country that totally abolished that, let it run its course, and if so, was it successful?
Well, I would say with the absence of significant interference in wages, that was true of the United States and Britain through the 19th century, and there was tremendous economic progress. And different countries are attempting to move in that direction. Some of the West European countries have finally realized that the very high unemployment rates that they have may have something to do with the power of the labor unions in those countries. And so they're attempting to weaken that. You won't find them confronting it head on, but I think that's implicit anyway. Yes?
I'm sorry, just in a just very brief.
Yeah?
The point you made very swiftly earlier about this free market and what we would look like if we had a free market.
Yeah.
The most common argument that I get in terms of arguing capitalism versus socialism, let's say, in that battle that goes on in our country presently, is how we're headed more and more towards the land of the have and have nots. So when you talk about the issue of efficiency, mm-hmm. for example, right, and we talk about innovation, then to your point, there are many individuals who have taken advantage. I'm one of them. Taking advantage of innovation, and therefore I can become wealthy.
Yeah,
I've done that.
Okay.
But then arguably there's another group that because of that innovation, they did not take the leap. They did not, learn the new skills.
Yeah.
And so as a result, they arguably became poor. And so it appears that we've got this elimination of the middle class, there's the have not. That almost got you the last time you did it, because you basically the way you laid it out, everybody would be more prosperous, those who are poor would become middle class.
Yeah.
I didn't quite...
Darwin.
No, it's not Darwin if everyone is improving.
I don't think
you see, if you think about it, you know, people often think of capitalism as survival of the fittest,
right.
Dog-eat-dog, the rat race. Now, just consider... we have competition among the pharmaceutical manufacturers. What's the effect of their competition on the ability of the sick to survive? It enables the sick to recover. What's the effect of competition among farmers and farm equipment manufacturers on the ability of the hungry to eat? It enables them to eat.
Right.
Now, you see, economic competition is not... like competition in the animal kingdom, the animals are competing for a scarce stock of nature-given necessities. There's only so many zebras in the jungle for the lions. The lions have no ability to enlarge the supply of zebras. Economic competition is a competition in the positive creation of new and additional wealth. IBM and Apple are competing not over grabbing computers off the computer trees, but they're competing in who can make a better, less expensive computer. And this is the nature of economic competition throughout, so it's positively augmenting the supply of goods. Now, if you think about it further, what's the basic way you make a fortune if you can't resort to force or fraud? Okay, you have to introduce better products or more efficiently produced products. What's the effect of that on the customers? It's improving it, right? And competition keeps passing the improvements forward. At one time, the way Intel made money, they introduced the 8286 chip, and that was very profitable and the hottest item. Well, what happened when others started making the equivalent chip? Then there's no special profit in the 8286. They need the 8386, and then competition wipes out that profit. Well, what's the net effect of this? People are getting better and better chips at lower and lower prices. And the same thing is true, really, across the board. We have automobiles introduced because someone made money. They're continually improved because someone made money. And it's this way up and down the line. So the way you make high profits is by introducing improvements. Mm-hmm. And then what do you do if you want to build a fortune? The source of a fortune is essentially the reinvestment of high profits. Well, as the fortune is accumulated and reinvested, where is it? Well, it's in things like machines and factories, the means of production. And who are the means of production physically producing for? The general consuming public. See, if we have a society in which there are people able to get rich by virtue of the improvements they bring about in production, and then they save and reinvest that wealth in the further means of production, well, this is a society in which this tremendous means of production using ever-improved technology. What's the effect of that on the supply of goods available for the masses? It's going up and up. And what's the effect if you have more wealthy business firms? What's the effect on the demand for labor? That goes up. So the non-capitalists, the people who are living by selling their labor, they're benefiting from the improved demand for labor and the improved supply of products that they buy. So there's a general benefit. Now, we don't observe everybody having the highest level of prosperity, in part because we have a heritage, the natural heritage of the human race was immense poverty. It took quite a while to elevate this. And we have a lot of interferences which stop it from going further. Of the kind I've illustrated. Now, there are many people who are poorer and worse off, despite a lot of progress that's been going on. And this seems to be a great puzzle to many people. But at the same time, if you stop and think of people's attitudes toward the cost of government regulation, like the Environmental Protection Agency will impose regulations that may cost tens of billions of dollars, or even more. God knows what the total cost of the environmental regulations has been over the last 20 years. Now, who do most people think pays for this? They think companies. They think. I read an article in the New York Times a week or two ago arguing that companies are paying 93% of the cost. Now, do you believe that if something is done that raises the cost of production, that this is coming out of profits for very long?
No.
It goes to into higher prices. So all of the new and additional regulations that are imposed, which serve to raise costs, and which most people think are coming out of the hides of the hated capitalists, they're actually coming out of the hides of consumers, and who, if they're at the lower end of the ladder, they're being impoverished. We have uncontrolled government regulation. See, we have an attitude, companies have to formulate the environmental impact of whatever they're doing. And who knows what that is? And that's pretty vague and undefined. But no one ever stops to consider what is the economic impact of these environmental regulations and other regulations. And if you're running up costs of tens and hundreds of billions of dollars without any concern, it shouldn't be all that amazing that there are going to be a lot of people who are made unnecessarily poor. And so I would say, if you want to explain a problem of poverty, the place to look is the run-up in costs imposed by government regulation. That would bear a lot of investigation. Yes, Mr. Chung?
Along the same line as with the government regulation, do you think that the benefit would shift to elsewhere? I mean, not necessarily, you know, diminish, you know, out the air. I mean, say, for instance, the EPA, you know, they impose, you know, different laws to, you know, and fines and so forth from businesses if they violate the law.
Mm-hmm.
While that benefit would keep it, I mean, the benefit of keeping the environment safe and good and so forth,
yeah,
does have an other benefit to other businesses, say, for instance, for farming and for, you know, other businesses, you know. So my point is that, you know, I mean, yes, government regulation, they do, you know, cost businesses to some extent, but the benefit of that cost shifts to another industry.
I think maybe what you have in mind, this was an idea presented by former Vice President Gore. I think he was making an argument of this kind, that there would be prosperity from manufacturing the pollution controls or whatever, the various devices. Now, that would give certain people extra work, but that doesn't mean that it's prosperity. Because suppose the work that they're doing is largely really unnecessary. They'll be doing it, but it doesn't mean that it's prosperous. They're not producing more goods and services. Suppose what we have is an arrangement that is going to lead to less production, and it will take more people to produce the same amount of goods. Well, we'll now have more people employed in certain aspects, but that doesn't mean that it's promoting prosperity. Yes, Mr. Weatherford.
Going back to the haves and have-nots of land and day we're talking about, let's look at the quality of haves and have-nots. Number one, there's never going to be total equality justice. That's a Marxist theory that's gone, you know.
Okay.
There's going to be no equality.
All right.
What is the quality of the poor today versus the in the United States versus the quality of the poor in the United States 100 years ago? 100 years ago, when you were talking poverty, you were talking about a person who might not eat that day, et cetera, et cetera. Today, when you're talking poverty, and in my business, I deal with a lot of people who are have not, you know.
No satellite
TV. It's no satellite TV. These people have housing. They have clothing. They have entertainment. They have cell phones. They have their own private transportation in the form of an automobile. You know, when welfare was invented, or just after welfare was invented, people went to the homes of welfare recipients. They weren't allowed to have television. They weren't allowed to have these things. Today, it's a given that they have them. So, all these poor people, you know, there's a lot of people in the world that would like to have that standard of living that our poor people have. You know.
I think that's a good observation, that what we're calling poverty is itself at a vastly higher level than it used to be.
Didn't you say that the United States and Great Britain were closest to free market during this time he's talking about, when the poverty level, when there was child labor, when people were not having enough to eat, were working in factories during that
that's
time,
right.
It was the freest market, but the standard of living was so far lower than it is today.
Yes, but now, see, you have to ask, what existed still earlier? But what were conditions in the Middle Ages? You see, the modern world began at the level of today's Bangladesh, or maybe lower than that. And the population of the world was frozen pretty much at about 1 billion people for many, many centuries until the 18th century, despite a very, very high birth rate. It was very common for women to have 10, 12 children, but only one or two might make it to adulthood because you had incredible infant mortality. I remember reading some years ago, this may not be true any longer, but perhaps a generation or so ago it was, that the average newborn American child had a better chance of living to age 65 than the average newborn Indian child had of living to age 5. Now, think of that sort of thing across the world. Think of conditions, the primitive state of medicine. If you lost a tooth, there was no dentistry ever to replace it. If you broke an arm, it would never be set properly. All kinds of diseases were very common. People were very malnourished, subject to plagues. Life was a horror. There was a movie some years ago, I think, with Sean Connery, I think In the Name of the Rose or something, that gave a good indication of the horrible poverty of that period. There are some others. People couldn't afford new clothing. They'd be wearing woolen clothing, second, third, and fourth hand. You can't wash wool very often. They'd be commonly lice infested. People who were somewhat better off wouldn't allow average people entry into their house because they would stink so badly. People were filthy, pockmarked, diseased. The average height of people was much less than today. If you go into a museum and you see suits of medieval armor, well, the average height of an adult male in Western Europe might have been a little over 5 feet because of miserable diet conditions. So that's where the world started. That was the kind of poverty. And then, slowly and gradually, things started to improve. It's true, the work week was horrendously long, conditions were horrible, pay was miserably low, but let's consider what sorts of things improved this. It was the fact that there were some more adventurous individuals, entrepreneurs, businessmen. Their first successes were in making the low-cost, mass-produced clothing. The first industry of the Industrial Revolution was the cotton textile industry. And who was it producing for? Who were the customers of the machine-produced cotton textiles? Not the wealthy ladies and gentlemen, but miserably poor people. They had mass production for the masses, and for the first time in history, poor people could get new clothing. And there were improvements in agriculture, the iron plow, the steel plow. Decade by decade, there were improvements. And you could see it in population figures. In Great Britain, the population by 1825 was probably double what it had been in 1800 after previous centuries of stagnation. The working conditions were still miserable, but the market, by virtue of raising real wages, you see what these improvements do, there's newer and better goods. They're more efficiently produced. And all of these improvements can be thought of as adding up to increasing the supply of goods in the market relative to the supply of labor in the market. As you increase the output per unit of labor, there are more goods relative to labor. So what is the effect of that on prices relative to wages? If we have more goods relative to labor, prices are falling relative to wages. What's that do to the buying power of wages? It raises it. It's raising real wages. So conditions were improving. Now, if you have a generation or more of this, let's say you start out, there are many, many people who barely to survive need to work 80 hours a week. Because if you produce miserably little per hour, and you have certain minimal indispensable requirements, the only way of living is to work horrendously long hours. Well, suppose because of these improvements in the output per hour of labor, a generation or two later, the real wages have doubled. Well, that puts a lot of people in a position in which they could afford to earn less than double, to have to work 60 hours instead of 80 hours, perhaps, or 70 hours instead of 80. They don't earn quite as much as they could, but they don't die if they work shorter hours. They can afford to work shorter hours. Well, as more and more people would prefer to work shorter hours, how does that make the market start to offer shorter hours? So you just think, if you're an employer and there are large numbers of workers, who have a preference for a shorter work week, and they're willing to back that preference by accepting wages that are a little more reduced than the hours. Like they'll work 7/8 the hours, but do so at 65% of the wages. Then won't you start offering that? Won't that be the economical thing to do?
Sure.
Well, that's how the market shortens the work week. It becomes economical as more and more workers have higher real wages and can afford to work shorter hours. And if that's what they want, then the market brings it about. And in a very similar way, it brings about improvements in working conditions. Now, suppose people need to work a certain number of hours to satisfy their requirements, and the government steps in and compels them to work less. I suppose we had a political party today that would say, you crazy Americans, you're working too much. What are you killing yourselves for? Let's work 30 hours a week. Would the government be doing us a favor?
No.
If we work 3/4, what should we expect to happen to how much we produce? We should produce on the order of 3/4. And what should that do to the prices we'd have to pay? That would go up. And even if our weekly wages stayed the same, even if they said, okay, we'll make the employers pay you that much more per hour, so you'll have the same amount per week, well, still, if we produce 3/4 and prices are 4/3, our standard of living is 3/4. Well, have we been benefited by a compulsory shortening of the work week? No. Analogously, there was child labor. Apart from the case of orphan children, who made the decision whether a child worked and how much? The parents. The parents did. Now, as the real earnings of the parents got higher and higher, they were in a position to keep their children home longer. So maybe in 1800, there were children working in some areas as early as the age of 5. But by 1850, it might be on the order of 10. By 1900, maybe 12. Today, 25 in many cases. Now just think, by the same token, you know the story of Swiss Family Robinson. Suppose there were a social worker who visited Swiss Family Robinson and saw they're having the children gather the firewood and do various other chores, and they wrote a report, this is unhealthy for the children, they need to rest and have an education, and then the social worker comes back with a policeman to impose this. Would that be helping Swiss Family Robinson? No. And when you stop child labor in miserably poor families, do you think you're helping them or making them poorer? You're making them poorer. If children in Bangladesh are producing soccer balls, that's very unfortunate that they have to do that, but are they better off being able to do that and earn something to avoid starvation than not to be able to have even that? Are we helping them by boycotting their soccer balls? I don't think so. Yes?
All right. Now, I realize this is a macroeconomics class,
mm-hmm.
and I personally am converted to capitalism. Mm-hmm. I was, like, after my first economics course, okay?
Okay.
But my problem is that probably the majority of people in this room are all employees, and mm-hmm. as employees in the United States, we pay almost 50% in taxes, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, due to an upcoming, you know, election...
50% of the taxes or 50%
of our income? Near, close to that. Let's just say 40%, whatever.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Of our take-home income goes to taxes. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so I realize that there's a lot of inefficiencies with unions. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, I love shopping at Walmart because I love Walmart prices. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, which is a non-union store.
Yeah.
But so I realize that there's inefficiencies with unions, and then I also realize, you know, so what are the, you know, unionized grocery stores and unionized airline employees doing? They're, you know, shifting to these kiosks and these self-checkouts, you know, so they're going to the machinery, right? And so, you know, in the short term, you know, you're going to have flight attendants or whoever out of the job, and you're going to have cashiers out of the job because of the machinery. So, because the unions can't fire them or else they'll get sued by the union, right? Or the grocery store can't, you know, fire the employees or lay off the employees, you know, et cetera, right? Because of the inefficiencies of union. But so we're in a capitalistic, free market economy that we pay like a lot of taxes, right? And if we elect the wrong person, we might have to pay more taxes, right? But that's another story for another day. But so on an individual basis, right? I go and I work for corporate America, right? Fortune 500. I'm going to try and climb the corporate ladder, right?
Yeah.
I'm going to pay 50% of my, you know, income to taxes for the rest of my life as an employee, right? And so, I guess, but corporate America has no loyalty to me, right? Like, they, if something goes wrong in the economy or something goes wrong in the company or even in my personal life,
yeah.
I'm disposable, right?
Yeah.
They could fire me like that for anything.
Yeah.
But yet, if I'm in a union, right, then I'm somewhat protected. So on an individual basis, like, you know, my pro-union, really I'm not. But, like, you know, I've seen the consequences of working in corporate America, you know, as an employee and,
yeah.
you know, people getting disposed of like that because, you know, they took more than 2 weeks vacation because they had a crisis in their family or,
yeah.
you know, the company had a downturn or whatever.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, I'm curious, what do you, how do you see that, like, on an individual basis, like, you know, people
okay.
suffer the consequences.
First, I would say, I don't know why you say we have such a free economy. The very fact that there are people paying 50% of their income in taxes,
right.
that's depriving them of half their freedom with respect to their income.
Right.
So that's not very free. Now, it's certainly true that a corporation has the right to fire a non-union employee with very little notice at its pleasure, but by the same token, you have the right to quit. Now, if you want guaranteed employment, the other side of that is you're not going to be able to leave either.
Right.
Now, it doesn't have to be as hard as it is to find an alternative job. It's very often the case that if you lose a given job, you're faced with really taking a plunge into a kind of abyss because you may not know where you can turn. Well, the solution to that, to make it possible for people to relocate with minimum hardship, is to make the economy as free as it possibly can be. So you just think, if you lose a given job because you've lost a competition, now that means you have to enter as a new competitor somewhere else.
Mm.
In what type of economy would you like to have to do that? In an economy that's wide open to your competition,
mm.
where anything that you're capable of doing, you can try to do, or an economy that's more or less substantially closed, where in order to get employed, you need to have seniority in a union.
Oh, I see.
See, the more controlled the economy is, the worse are the consequences of losing a given job, and it's kind of paradoxical. The more controlled an economy is, the greater is the burden that bears down on people who are left with some degree of freedom, and they think that they need controls to protect themselves. So you think you need to belong to a union. Well, you wouldn't need to belong to a union if the rest of the economy were open to your competition. You should really be moving in the opposite direction.
As an individual, I could be just as disloyal to the Fortune 500 company as they are to me, because, you know, I'm just out and there's, I can
yeah.
move from, you know, Coke to Pepsi like that.
And you would.
Yeah.
You would, and people do.
Right.
Yes.
What does that do to productivity?
Which?
When there's that lack of freedom. Seems that desire, the motivation to earn or to be productive is driven by a desire to attain. So if you're
yeah.
not able to attain, are you likely to become productive?
But if you're deprived of the ability to improve, you're not going to be productive.
So
if you had
lacking these freedoms, you can't attain as much.
Yeah, to the extent that you're not free. See, the basic thing is, to be free means what you're free of is the threat of physical force by other people, above all, by the government.
Or you get taxed to no end.
Well, getting taxed to no end, that's a violation of your freedom.
Why increase your earning if they're going to take half, so why become more efficient?
Well, that's a serious problem. But you see, in the nature of the case, if you're free, and you will then be free to pursue your self-interest. You'll be free to do good to yourself. And if other people can't resort to force and they want to deal with you, what do they have to do to get you to deal with them? They have to serve your self-interest. You have mutual self-interest. When people are free, they're each out to serve their own self-interest, and if they can't resort to force, they have to serve the self-interest of the people they deal with. So you have this tremendous synergy. Now, to the extent that people are not free, what not being free means, you are prohibited from serving your self-interest, or you're compelled to act against your self-interest. that's what happens when you're forced. You see, if you weren't forced, you wouldn't voluntarily act against your self-interest. It takes force to make you act against your self-interest, or to stop you from acting for your self-interest. So then self-interest is less well served. I'm sorry to have held you
up. That's okay. Another comment. I think the reason the free market system works so well in the United States as opposed to other countries in Western Europe is because of the ability of social mobility here. You can be born into a poor family here and go on to become the president of the United States. Most countries in Western Europe, if you're a working man, you always stay a working man. You do the same thing as your father. So people are more likely to want to adopt socialistic systems, whereas here, people are always striving to do something better. They always want their kids to be better than they were. It seems like the system works better, and the other countries, not so.
Well, I'm sure there is a broad overlap that what you say has a lot of application, but I think if a country is truly free, then that means that someone born to working class parents, but who has the ability himself, there would be nothing to stop him.
But most countries in Western Europe, that doesn't happen.
If it doesn't happen, it's because there are such networks of wheeling and dealing with government intervention. You see, suppose you live in a society where, in which to do anything, you need certain critical political approvals. Well, who's going to be networked in a way to obtain these approvals? Well, someone with the right background and connections. And if you don't have any of that, you just may not be able to break through. But if the government was less involved, then you wouldn't have such need for connections. So I would say the perpetuation of that kind of system is probably the result, not the cause of the problems. Now, I see a certain restlessness. Is my watch slow? I have 22. Pardon me? That's right. Okay. But, yeah, last question.
No.
Okay. All right. So I think I perceive a desire to hit the road. So, all right. I think tonight's class has been very interesting, and I'm very glad so many of you have participated. And I look forward to seeing you all next week. Have a great week.